When you go to a Western, you know, an old movie, especially old-time movies, and they try and convey the image of living in the West a couple of hundred years ago, they often have little churches, little weatherboard churches, where people sing hymns and someone pumps out a harmonium very badly. And the hymn they nearly always sing, there's two hymns they nearly always sing in those Western movies. One is Bringing in the Sheaves, and the other one that they love to sing is Rock of Ages. It has that old world grinding kind of melody to it, and it has the kinds of words that indeed people were singing 100 or so years ago. I raise it to you because it's an important, it's a great illustration of our passage today. It was written by a man with the most unlikely name of Augustus Toplady. I think if I had a name like that, I too would want to be remembered in history after all my parents had inflicted upon me all my life. He was born 250 years ago this year, 4th of November. Anyone born on the 4th of November here? Well, there you go. Amongst a group like this, you'd expect just random chance there was a possibility. But 4th of November, you've got Augustus Toplady's birthday 250 years later. And he wrote this hymn, Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Well, when we turn to today's study, some of us will experience the power of God. That's a fairly bold claim, but today, here in this lecture theatre, my expectation is that some of us will experience the power of God. And for some of us, it may actually be for the first time. Now, it will not be a magic show. We're not going to see any miraculous signs. We're not going to have any weird sensations that I'm anticipating or expecting. You're not going to see somebody suddenly light up and their hair stand out in their end, their eyes turn orange and their heads revolve on their shoulders. That is not experiencing the power of God. I'm not quite sure what you're experiencing, but it's not the power of God. God actually makes heads to face one way and he generally doesn't rotate them. Well, what would it be to experience the power of God? It will be to be transformed personally and, more importantly, relationally. It will be experienced through words, which seem to be pretty stupid, really. I mean, you hear lots of words in lots of lecture theatres like this, but what I say to you will actually carry God's power to you as you grasp hold of the message that is being said. And as that message comes to you and you understand what it is actually implying for you, God can change and will change you. For this is the power of God of which Paul writes back in chapter 1, verse 16, 17. For the power of God is a righteousness from God that is revealed in the gospel. And I'm going to reveal to you today the righteousness of God. Not the righteousness just of God, but to make it clearer, the translation puts it, the righteousness that comes from God to us. The righteousness that you cannot do yourself, you cannot get it, you cannot acquire it, you cannot by your shoestrings pull yourself up to it. It's the righteousness that God bestows and gives to people. A righteousness from God that transforms your relationship with Him, and with that transformed, it then changes your relationships with other people, and it also changes your very relationship with yourself, both in this world and in the world to come. And so Leon prayed for us as we started to hear that I might speak it truthfully, and it's important we are praying that we might hear and understand it properly. Verse 21 of chapter 3 starts off, but now, because it's really pointing back to the whole argument that has taken place so far, chapters 1, 2 and 3, about man's problem with sin and man's solution to sin that doesn't work and God's problem with sin. God's solution for sin is just what the verses are going to be about. Well, let's look at man's problem with sin, which is just a review of chapters 1 to 3. The problem is that we reject God, and this is universal, which chapter 3 argues is universal for Jews and for Gentiles. All of us have failed to live. There's no one righteous, no, not one. We've all chosen to live for ourselves. We've all got the symptoms, like the symptom of lie. I saw a very interesting article in the Sydney Morning Herald this week about children and lying. And everybody lies. A man spent 3 years studying lying. I don't know why he spent so long. I could have told him almost everything he found out. Just from Bible reading, you don't need to do any surveys. People everywhere tell lies. And they tell lies for just completely self-centered, selfish reasons. And yet they all agree that telling lies is bad. The very things they don't want to do, they do. It's a universal phenomenon. The Bible says so. But of course, lies are just the symptom. It's got to do with a profound rejection of God. Now, the real problem with sin lies in God's reaction to it, namely wrath. In the first place, it's partial. He's just given us up. He's given us over to live out the consequences of our lies, but he's not given us over totally. He still sends the rain and the sun and the crops. But it's then for a world of confusion and injustice, because the rain comes not just on the wicked. The sun doesn't just burn the wicked. The rain comes on the just and the unjust, says Jesus. And so evil is not fairly dealt with here in this world. There are some monstrous acts that seem to go unpunished. While at the other time, there are apparently innocent people who are victims of such monstrous acts. Who does know what's taken place with the police forces and growing marijuana? Who is the innocent and who is the guilty and who's actually being punished? And the world is like that. It's all mucked up and confused because God has let us have our head. And yet he hasn't pulled back completely. That is yet to come. There will be a permanent day of justice of wrath when each one will be judged according to their merits individually and finally. That is what is being promised in chapter 2, verse 16 and chapter 2, verse 5, that the day of God's wrath will come when it will be done properly. But of course, at that point, none of us will escape. In the meantime, what we tend to do is to presume upon God's patience. We presume that because we haven't been punished for the wrong that we've done, that God's not angry. We presume that because we haven't been punished for the wrong that we've done, that we will never have to pay for our deeds. We presume because we haven't paid for the wrong that we've done, that there will be no day of reckoning, that you can get away with things in this world. And even though sickness and death and disasters warn us that all is not right with the world, they are the trumpet warnings of God, the scriptures say. Whenever you hear of a calamity, whenever you hear of the earthquake and destructions, they say, they declare to you, something's not right with this world. When you have a friend who has a cancer, when you have a close relative who dies, you'll say, this is not right, it shouldn't be like this. And God is saying, no, it's not right, it shouldn't be like this. But yet, we still think that we're not going to pay for the wrong that we've done. And even when we have yearnings for justice and equity and fairness, even when inside our hearts we say, I wish the world was a place where, we still do not listen to our own hearts and recognise that God is telling us that there is a day of judgment. God's wrath has been forecast. We now have a foretaste in this disastrous world, but it is coming. And so humans have invented solutions for sin. You'll see there that in the days of non-sexist language that I put man down as the one responsible all here, and if sexist language offends you, you can change the word man there in point two, man's problem with sin, man's solution with sin, and just write the word my. Because it's not just man, it's my problem that we're really dealing with. My solution for sin is every person's solution for sin. That is morality. Rules and regulations, the laws, and none better, of course, than the rules and regulations of God, God's laws. That if I could keep God's laws, I'll be okay. I'll be all right with him. In one sense, if I could, I would, but I can't. And so I'm not. And so I then kind of change the laws a little bit, and I say, well, provided I'm better than average, that, you know, 51% of my performances are good and only 49% are bad, God will be pleased. But, of course, I have come to learn, thanks to the wonders of statistics, that pass marks have got much more to do with the number of people you beat than the actual mark you get. And so it's not being 51% good, it's just being in the top 50% of the community, isn't it? That's all that counts. I mean, the essence of morality is being better than my neighbour. And the essence, therefore, of being a moral person is hanging around with rotten people. As long as I hang around with real louses, then I've got a good chance of being a good person. I only have to be better than them, and you should see some of my friends. The essence of morality, therefore, is always boastful. It's like those moral stickers that you see on the back of motor cars. They're about athletic things, but that's about the only morality Australians have anymore. You know, I made it. The essence of that, you see, is arrogance and pride and boastfulness, hasn't it? I notice this because I've never made it. Or that other one about the car, it's usually put on the back of a bomb, a Volkswagen or something like that. And you'll see on the back of it saying, the sticker, you know, this may be a bomb, but it's in front of you. There's that essence that my status has to do with beating you. And it has to do with my achievements. That's why, of course, we hate Christians. Because they always sound so arrogant. They always sound so, well, so big on themselves, that they are so moral, that they are acceptable to God. That they are so good that God will be pleased with them. That they are somehow holier than thou. That they are somehow claiming to be better than me. Christians are very objectionable people. And of course, it's also why we think Christians are hypocrites. Because we know they're no better than us. And we are looking forward to seeing them slip and fall flat on their face. And those of us who are inside Christianity, if you believe that being a Christian is being moral, it's why you can never be sure that you've been acceptable to God. Because it doesn't matter how good you are, you always keep on meeting someone who's slightly better. It doesn't matter how good you are, you know you're not perfect. And you expect God will want you to be perfect. It doesn't matter how good you are so far, well, what about next week or the week after? No, you can never really win on morality with God. It's like the old lady who came to the pastor and said to her that she really thinks she was a Christian now because for the last week she hasn't sinned once, and she's very proud of it. In chapter 3, verse 20, it's made clear that no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by obeying the law. Morality is a very high principle, low performance activity for humans. We all have it, great standards, but we all fail it. Doesn't matter what the standards are, let alone God's standards. And morality has got to do with arrogance if we're successful, or unreality about how successful we are, or depression if we're truthful. So here is the problem. All who sin are going to face the wrath of God. All do sin. Therefore, all will face the wrath of God. We hope that law will save us, but the law doesn't save us, it condemns us. The law just makes us conscious of how sinful we are. So the problem of humanity is that every one of us is born and travelling along the road to death and destruction and the wrath of God. But if we have a problem, and we certainly do, God has a problem also. We can be so dominated by the fact that we're going to hell that we don't pay much attention to God's problem, but God has a problem as well. You see, his response of wrath and anger is just. It's not losing his temper, it's right. His creation has been mucked up by these people who have rejected him and his way to live. They've ruined each other. They've ruined themselves. They've ruined the world, the beautiful world he's made. And being just and right, he is slow to anger. He's not just fickle, and he certainly hasn't lost control. He is going to give us what we ask for. But God's problem starts with his delay. For part of the reason of his delay is that he wishes some people to be saved. Part of the problem with the delay is that now sin is already going unpunished. It's not being dealt with equitably. People kill, they lie, they maim, they pillage, they lust, and nothing happens. And the cry goes up, where is the God of justice? Where is the justice of God? Here is the problem that you get given to you in philosophy exercises as the problem of evil. If God is all-powerful, if God is all-loving, why is there evil in the world? It's always presented to you as if no Christian has ever thought of it, let alone the Bible having anything to say about it. Nearly the whole Bible is about the subject and says many, many things that I've never heard discussed in a philosophy class, of which I've sat through, unfortunately, many. The Bible won't put it in exactly those terms, but it's the same issue. It's God's problem of how he can justify the guilty. How can God give mercy, give forgiveness, give pardon to people and still remain just? You see, God's delay is to give people the opportunity to repent, to provide the opportunity for mercy to be given to them. But how can God justify the guilty? You see, there are two dreadful injustices in the world that we see all too commonly. That is, someone who is completely innocent being put in prison. And the other one, someone who is completely guilty being let go free. Both of those are wrong, aren't they? It's an awful thing when the innocent is punished, and it's a dreadful thing when the guilty are excused. God's justice can't really be maintained, excusing the guilty. So how can God, who is just, ever justify the guilty? But if he doesn't justify the guilty, well then, friends, evil has won. For through the work of evil, God's creation has been destroyed. When he does let go the guilty, then he is saying that sin doesn't matter. Or he is saying that he too is sinful because he is willing to be unjust. Especially if God is to act impartially, he can have no special deals for his friends. He can't say, well, I'll let you in because I like the colour of your hair, and okay, you can come in too because you endured arts, and then you can come in because you can run fast. God can't show favouritism. If he forgives everybody, then there is no justice. If he forgives only some people, there's no justice. If he forgives nobody, well, there'll be justice, but there'll be the victory of evil, the destruction of God's universe. One of the most famous Australians outside of Australia, who you never hear much about in Australia, is a man called Paul White, the jungle doctor. He's written many, many books, translated into hundreds of languages all around the world, and is very well known outside of Australia. He's written an autobiography, which is really a delightful book, called Alias Jungle Doctor. It's a great read. He's a very funny man. It's a very interesting, very moving story, full of pathos and tragedy and full of great fun. And he writes, towards the end of his book, about a friend of his who was the Deputy Commissioner of Police, Mr. W.J. Lawrence. He was not only a friend, but also a patient. And he said, one Sunday, on the way home from church, I was booked for exceeding the speed limit of 35 miles per hour. It was the old days. And the next day, I was visited by a policeman who gave me a handwritten letter from my friend, Mr. Lawrence, the Deputy Commissioner of Police. Dear Paul, I see you are booked for driving at 42 miles per hour and that you admitted your guilt. I couldn't strike your name off the report, for that would have been unjust and illegal. You see, at some stage in the history of New South Wales, police commissioners have been just. I hope it's the so today. It wouldn't be just, would it, to say, oh, well, Paul, he's my friend. Look, forget about him. That is exactly what the just judge must not do. He's got to say the penalty must be paid, even though he's my friend. The penalty must be paid. So here's God's solution for sin, which brings us to the passage today, really, the right-hand side of your outline. This is where you find God's power to break our problem and to break his problem. But first you need to see some technical terms that are used in the passage. There are five of them there, you'll see in your outline. I've got three of them up on the on an overhead for you so that you'll get the wording correctly. The first one comes from the law courts. It's a word which is translated variously in English as righteousness, or justification. They're all the same one Greek word. That help? It's all the same set of Greek words. Now you see it there in verse 20. righteous, verse 21, a righteousness from God apart from the law. Verse 22, this righteousness from God. Verse 24, and are justified, same Greek word, justified, righteous. Or you see it down there in verse 26, it occurs about three times. He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. It's a key word, and it's the word of the judge to acquit. That is, to declare that a person is free from penalty. To declare that a person is right with the court. It's not to make you righteous, but rather to legally declare that you are righteous. Very important that you catch hold of the idea of declaration. It's what the judge does. He says, this person is all right with the court. He is acquitted. The second word comes from the slave markets. It's to redeem. To redeem means to purchase freedom of somebody, usually in the slave markets. It can be something. That is, to ransom something. A slave, of course, very common in the first century Roman world. And you could get out of slavery by the payment of a price. We still use the words redemption and redeeming and ransoming, particularly in hijacking and kidnapping, where it's again the same idea, isn't it? You pay over something. And in the payment over of that something, it could be some other captive, you know, you let someone else's captive free, but in the payment of a price, the hijacker, the kidnapper lets you go free or whatever, whoever he is caught. It's also used in pawnbroking. Those of us who are really poor students know about it, that when you go to get your watch back out of the pawnbroker, you redeem your watch. You pay back the price plus the interest and you get your watch back and you redeem your watch. The third word is to atone, and it comes from the temples. It's a sacrificial word, and it's talked about. The redemption word comes there in verse 24, freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus, and verse 25 gives you an atonement. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. Now, to atone is to make amends, to make reparation for a wrong or for an injury. You've just got your watch out of the pawnbroker, you show it to me, I say, that's a lovely watch, I take hold of it, I throw it on the ground, and I stamp on it and crush it into little bits and pieces. Now, at that point, there is a little chance that you're offended. You might even have a bit of a peek, be slightly angry with me. Now, what can I do to make amends? What can I do to atone you? Well, I can say sorry, that would be a good starter, wouldn't it? And would you be satisfied with that? I suspect not. I suspect you want more than me just saying sorry, that actually won't turn your anger aside. There'll be something else you would like as well, like a new watch. Now, when I bought you a new watch to replace that one, then you will be atoned. Your anger, oh, well, it's all right. Now, I've got the watch now and you've said sorry. Okay, I accept it. Of course, you mightn't be like that. You might say, no, no, you've broken my watch. I want two watches, one for each wrist from here on in. That would be an unjust atonement that would need to take place. But the person who is offended is the person who sets the price of atonement. The sacrificial system was all about atoning God's anger. We have offended against God, and God says that he will accept the death of a lamb in our place. And so sacrifices were made in order to turn aside God's anger. Now, there are two other technical words that are there, not on the overhead, two other technical words that are there. The one is grace, which just means generosity, means giving. That's the idea of grace. It's free and an unmerited gift. And you see that in verse 24, that we are justified, declared all right with the judge, freely by God's generosity, through the payment of a price to release the slaves, through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. You see how you need these words to make sense of the sentences there. And the last one is faith, which occurs in verse 22, 26 and the like. And faith, we're going to deal with in detail next week as to what it is and isn't. But faith means to rely, to depend, to trust. It's not a religious word. It's not a feeling. It's not an experience. Faith is just relying on something, depending upon something, trusting something. When you get on the bus and the bus driver says he's going to take you to Central Railway, you trust that he can drive the bus. You trust that he knows the way to Central Railway. You trust that he's not a hijacker. That is having faith in the bus driver. You do it 100 times every day, usually without any thought. Now, God's solution is Jesus. That is God's solution in one single word. It's the solution to man's sin and to God's problem. So verses 21, 22, now a righteousness from God, apart from the law, has been made known. The law and the prophets testify to it. It's not against the law, but it's just independently of the law. There's a new way. Verse 22, this righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. It is through Jesus that the righteousness comes from God. And it's one that comes by faith in Jesus. Now, the first thing you see that explaining how Jesus is the solution is to talk in terms of the law word, in terms of righteousness, in terms of justification. Verse 26, he did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time so that he might be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. God is going to make a legal decision. He's going to look at you and say, you're all right with me. I am the judge, you're right with me. That doesn't solve the problem for you, does it? Because on what grounds can God say that I'm right with him? Because I'm not right with him. I've done rotten things. The second set of ideas is how he shows you. You're justified freely, verse 24, through redemption. That is, the way in which God can declare you to be right with him is by God paying the penalty to free you from your bondage. Just as you pay a penalty to free a slave, so God has paid a penalty to free you. What is the penalty that God has paid? Why, his own son, Jesus. Because through his blood, this redemption came. And how? How did God pay Jesus over that we might be redeemed? Which takes us to verse 24. Because God made a sacrifice for us. For God presented his son Jesus as a sacrificial atonement. His blood was shed for me in my place. That is, God in Christ paid the penalty for me. God took my sin and his wrath upon himself so that the penalty would be paid for me so that he could then say, the debt is paid for Philip Jensen. Let him go. He is all right with me. Listen to Paul Weiss. The letter comes from Mr. Lawrence, the police commissioner who was a Christian. I see you were booked for driving at 42 miles per hour and that you admitted your guilt, and I could not strike your name off the report because that would have been unjust and illegal. But I could and did pay your fine for you. I'm sure you'll see the analogy. Well, every Christian would see the analogy. The God who cannot just let the wicked go free, but does pay the penalty for them. And in paying the penalty for them, maintains justice and extends mercy. He paid the price. You see, this is what Augustus Toplady discovered. He was in a huge storm one day as he walked home. And as he was in this storm, he saw a big rock and the rock had a big crack in it. And so he hid himself in the crack, in this cleft in the rock, so as to protect himself from the storm. And while there, he perceived what an image it was of being a Christian. And it's a marvellous hymn. Rock of ages that was cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Because he sees in that Christ, you see, let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flowed, you remember the water and blood came out of the crucified Jesus' side, be of sin the double cure, cleanse me from its guilt and power. Not the labours of my hand can fulfil thy law's demands. Could my zeal no respite know, could my tears forever flow, all for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. You see how verse 2 has caught Romans 1 to 3? There's nothing I can do that could ever make me right with God. There's nothing I could ever do that could atone for the sin. There's no price I could ever pay that would redeem me from my slavery. Thou must save, and thou alone. Nothing in my hand I bring. Simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace. Foul, I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. While I draw this fleeting breath, when mine eyelids close in death, when I soar through tracks unknown, see thee on thy judgment throne. Rock of ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. It's a great hymn, for it is really understood what Romans 1 to 3 is teaching, that this is the real solution for God's problem. For in this, God can demonstrate his justice, taking sin with utmost seriousness, and still, verse 26, justify the ungodly, like me. It solves our problem because my crime has now been paid for. I am declared right, not because of the keeping of the law, but because of what God has done for me. And because of that, I can now face my evil deeds. We're going to find out more about that in chapter 5. That I am now don't have to hide.